who is director of the Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy at Columbia University. He took his PhD in sociology at Harvard. His research endeavors have been remarkably varied in subject matter and have drawn on a number of subdisciplines within sociology. He has a lengthy publication list and has written several books, one of them with the intriguing title, Doorman. The topic of Professor Behrman's lecture tonight is understanding the increased prevalence of autism. He's singularly well qualified to talk about the many puzzles of the incidence of autism and how they might be unraveled. I say that in part because in 2007, the National Institutes of Health awarded him a $2.5 million Director's Pioneer Award to support his research into autism's social determinants. Would you please welcome our speaker?
Thanks a lot for the nice introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here, and you know, I really appreciate all the people who came on a beautiful spring day, and I guess I've just learned it's also spring break, so I thank you a lot for coming. The talk focuses on the rising prevalence of autism cases in the United States and elsewhere, and Canada is one of the elsewhere places, and the general logic for trying to understand why autism is increased is that if we can understand the sources of the rising prevalence, then we might understand something about the causes of autism. And if we can understand something about the causes, we might be able to prevent future cases that arise subsequently. So that's the motivation. I think the first thing I should say is that the work that I'm doing is part of a large group. These are my collaborators, a number of postdocs and a number of BA students who have just finished their BAs and are working with me. So much of what you see tonight is a collective enterprise that this small group has done over the last 18 months. It's often the case that people in general audiences wonder what social science can bring to bear on such a problem as a search for a cause for health disorders. And obviously, sociologists are not geneticists, we're not neurologists, we're not molecular biologists, toxicologists, or any of the other disciplines that get under the skin. Because we don't get under the skin, there are certain things that we can't say about ultimate cause. But the claim I'm going to make today is that there are lots of things that we can say about cause, and hopefully, you know, at the end of this 45 minutes or an hour, you'll conclude with me, or I hope you'll conclude with me, that some of the things we'll say are actually useful. Before I say much more about autism, I'll make two simple points which motivate everything that we've been doing and actually everything that you'll see tonight. And the two points are, first, that space matters, and that if we could understand the spatial structure of autism, that will provide really fundamental clues for our understanding of the causes of the disorder. And then the second comment is that time matters. And if we can understand the temporal pattern of the increased prevalence of autism and the changing ways in which risk factors express themselves over different times, we'll also be able to begin to make some sense of the increased prevalence of autism. This slide is almost impossible for you to see, and that's okay, but it's a very old map produced by John Snow, who founded Public Health, and it's Snow's map of the cholera epidemic in London, and the little black dots he went around and he identified all the mortalities in London, and what he discovered is something that we now know, which is that the cholera epidemic of London that killed so many people was centered around the Broad Street pump. And as a consequence of this fundamental understanding of the spatial distribution of cholera, he also discovered something that's fundamentally important, which is cholera is a waterborne disease. So in the same way, I'm going to try, as this talk goes on, to exploit the fact that there's a spatial structuring to the increased to autism incidence, and then try to infer from that spatial clustering what we might learn about autism. And of course, space is both physical and social, and this is another example of the way in which social epidemiologists discovered something fundamental about a disease. This is the social network surrounding Gaetan Dugas, who was identified as Agent Zero in the early years of the HIV epidemic, an airline steward. And all of these people subsequently contracted HIV, and that's his sexual partner network. And it was data like this that gave rise to the first bit of information that told us that HIV was transmitted through the exchange of fluids. So the second idea of the talk is that we can learn a lot about autism if we pay some deep attention to the way in which social structure, the patterns of social relations in which people are embedded in, influence how they learn about the disorder, how they move forward to bring resources to their children and so on. So those are two justifications that I'll use to start the talk. And the only other thing to say is that autism is enormously more complicated than cholera or HIV. And so it's going to take a long time for us to figure out what drives the increased prevalence, but I think we'll get there. This slide is the problem that we're going to try to explain, which is drawn from the United States. If you look at the United States, we can look at autism prevalence from 1970. This is the green line up to 2005. This is cases per 10,000 persons. And what you can see if you follow the green line, of course, is that there's enormous increased prevalence. So this is something that we know, is that the incidence of autism is increasing. The green dots are the study estimates that arise from particular small populations at different moments in time. So you can also see a couple other important things. One is that the more studies, along with increased prevalence, there are more studies. And then along with more studies, there are wilder and wilder estimates of prevalence. So the prevalence estimates jump all up and down this space. The data that I'm going to talk about arise from California, and they're represented by this magenta line. And they're a little bit different than the green line, and that's why they're on a somewhat different scale. The magenta line captures a concept called a birth cohort. I'm going to look at the birth cohorts of kids born from 1992 to 2000. So a birth cohort born in 1992 is 6 years old in 1998, at which point they would be fully ascertained for autism. So if the age of diagnosis over this period has moved from age 6 down to about age 3 in the United States, and comparably changed in Canada as well, the birth cohort of 1992, we would get an estimate of the autism incidence in 1998 for them. So our first observation is for 1998. Our last observation is for 2006, which is the birth cohort of 2000, all children born in 2000. This is the mess that I'm trying to avoid. It's just a slice of findings taken out of journal articles, Science Times, and everywhere else, in which we are identified all sorts of tiny little things that cause autism. Here are some of my favorites: TV, school lunch. Some of these are risk factors that cause autism. Some of these are reported in the literature to be protective factors. TV is a risk factor, power lines are risk factors, microwaves. School lunch is reported to be a protective factor in the literature, and obviously that's absurd because school lunch, the provision of a free school lunch, cannot protect you from autism. What that means is that kids who get free school lunches are poor, and poverty is a risk factor for not being ascertained. So the literature seems to relentlessly identify single factors as causing or protecting persons from autism. And the general problem is that the factors are too many. The samples from which they're drawn are completely heterogeneous with respect to the populations. They're often very small. They're quite likely selective. And in technical language, the literature confuses correlated time series with cause. So if we look over the period from 1970 to 2000, we could say, well, what's changed? Well, there's been a rise in emo music. So if you thought that emo music caused autism, you'd say, gee, emo music is going up and autism is going up, and let's get an article published on that. There's been a decline in station wagons, and so we could say the decline in station wagons has produced autism, or an increase in frozen yogurt. So I'm trying to get away from arguments of this sort, and the only way to do it is to figure out how to develop data structures that are not too small, not heterogeneous, and allow us to control for time. And that's what we're going to do This is the most boring part of every talk. It describes the data that a researcher uses. In our case, we've built a rather huge data set, which in its first instance captures every child born in California from 1992 to 2004, including their residence at birth, their residence at diagnosis, their maternal and paternal characteristics, all the characteristics of moms and dads, the relevant prenatal conditions, whether the birth is breech, whether the baby's premature, Apgar score, and so on, for about 7 million kids. That's about 500,000 kids a year who are born in California. So that's the total population of all children born in California. We've linked those data to all persons born who are in California diagnosed with autism over the period from 1992 to 2006. And for all persons in California diagnosed with autism registered through the Department of Developmental Services, we have yearly evaluations for those individuals and their diagnostic status. We've captured, therefore, about 440,000 persons with autism, about 140,000 persons with mental retardation, and about 17,000 persons with epilepsy. And then because we know where every child is born in California, we're also able, for all children who have a sibling born in the same period from 1992 to 2006, to make every family that's ever observed in California that has more than two children. And I'll use some of that data subsequently to look at the way in which autism runs in families and to try to disentangle genetic from other causes of autism. So we have information on households, all the organizations in a community that are relevant for the provision of autism service, neighborhood characteristics, schools, every physician, and a complete toxin registry. So this is what we've been doing for the last 18 months, is building a data set like that, and the first results are coming up. The general idea about how to account for the increased incidence of autism is to identify a class of general theoretical approaches. One approach that's favored by sociologists is to say that the increased prevalence or the epidemic arises from diagnostic change, that it's a diagnostic epidemic in its main features, and that because it's a diagnostic process, what's really going on is increased surveillance, and by virtue of increased surveillance, increased ascertainment. So that question is neutral with respect to the question, were people not ascertained earlier and are now being ascertained with autism, or are we over-diagnosing? It's simply identifying a process, there's diagnostic change, and as a consequence, we're observing more persons with autism. So that's one class of arguments. The second class of arguments focus on genetic factors and gene-environment interactions. The third class of arguments focuses on fundamental changes in family and demographic dynamics that might be associated with genetic change or might simply be associated with increased risk for autism. There's a whole class of arguments focused on increased environmental toxicity, of which one version is the vaccine theory. And finally, there's the class of arguments that would identify a social influence mechanism as helping parents lead their children to treatment if they're at risk to autism. So in the talk today, I'm going to talk in about 1 second about diagnostic change. I'm going to spend a few minutes on a genetic mechanism that we think we've identified for autism, which is an interaction between a genetic factor and family change. I'm going to talk about how time matters for our thinking about autism, and I'll use the example of maternal and paternal age as risk factors. But the example will be generalized to all risk factors. And then finally, I'm going to talk about the fact that we can observe spatial structuring of autism. That is, we can observe spatial clusters where there are more than expected numbers of children with autism. And I'm going to talk about what that means. And the first thing that means is that autism cannot be caused by a global treatment. That is, a global treatment like vaccines, which is insensitive to space, cannot cause spatial clustering. So if we observe spatial clustering, we know that something local, either environmental or social, underlies the increased incidence. So that's the structure of the talk. Again, the two big themes are going to be time matters. Changes over time in the characteristics of persons with autism will mean that different risk factors will appear to be different at different times, even if they're not. So that's the first point. And the second point is space matters. The presence of autism clusters, their structure, their continuity, and their composition will tell us something about autism in exactly the same way that John Snow's map of the cholera epidemic in London told him something important about cholera. Now, let me make a couple comments on diagnostic change. First of all, there's an overwhelming reality that there's been a significant change in the diagnostic criteria for autism over this period. The criteria have expanded on both sides of the spectrum for autism, both on the severe and high-functioning sides of the disorder. And as a consequence, many observers and many social scientists argue that diagnostic substitution, that is, substitution of a child comes in and gets a diagnosis, instead of getting a diagnosis of mental retardation, we'll get a diagnosis of autism. Many observers have argued that diagnostic substitution on the MR pathway is contributing to increased incidence. And one of the reasons that you might, and social scientists believe that you should expect to see some diagnostic substitution, is that there's been a reversal of stigmas associated with autism. So when autism was associated with as a psychogenetic disorder, as versus a developmental disorder, it carried a lot of stigma. And as we understand autism now to be a connectivity developmental disorder, the stigma has decreased at the same time as the stigma for mental retardation has increased. So we observe a crossover. We can ask the question, what role does diagnostic change play in increasing the caseload? And the answer is, you can read in a paper, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, that's forthcoming in the International Journal of Epidemiology, which is that we can estimate that since about 1992, about 25% of the increased prevalence of autism in California is a consequence of diagnostic change operating on the population of persons with mental retardation. Another way of saying that is about 1 in 4 children who are diagnosed with autism today would not have been diagnosed with autism had they been born in 1993. They would have been diagnosed with mental retardation. Now, you might think that's a lot, or you might think that's not very many. From my point of view, what it does is two things. The first is that it leaves 3 out of 4 cases completely unexplained. And the second thing it does is it tells me that there's something important going on with respect to the differential diagnosis of autism and autism comorbid with mental retardation. And so I'm going to focus a little bit on that later. So that's my comment on diagnostic change. Let me turn then to a puzzle. Autism is generally believed to be the most genetic of all neuropsychiatric disorders, with heritability estimates, if you read the literature, at 0.9, which is about as high as you can go. So we believe that it's the most genetic of all neuropsychiatric disorders, but at the same time, the prevalence of autism has increased far too rapidly to be caused by fundamental changes in human genetics. Human genetics simply cannot transform themselves in such a short period of time. So how do we square that circle that this puzzle produces? And one way to do it is to look at data and try to figure out what we might learn. Remember that I said that I can build every family in California, and so we built all the families in California, and that allows us to estimate the concordance of twin and sibling pairs. By concordance, we mean if a single child has autism, then simply what's the probability that the sibling pair or the twin pair will also be diagnosed with autism. And what we can first discover is, if we look at the pattern of concordance, is that it's not consistent with a straightforward genetic explanation. And what I'll show you on the next slide is that fraternal twins are 2.6 times more likely to be concordant for autism than full siblings, even though genetically fraternal twins and full siblings share the same exact genetic resemblance. So there's something puzzling there. And of course, that means that since fraternal twins are more likely to have autism than full siblings, it means that something about the environment, the prenatal environment, or the environment in which the children are born, are likely important. Still, there's incredible evidence that there is a lot of heritability for autism, and autism is more likely to run in families or not. So this is a study for all sibling and all twin pairs in California. The data on heritability for autism, the estimates of 0.9, arise from 4 studies with a total population of 126 pairs. So we have thousands of sibling pairs here and 631 twin pairs. We can look at all twins, and we can discover that about 37% of them are concordant. If one twin is diagnosed with autism, then 37% of the pairs will be. We can look at same-sex twins. Half of same-sex twins are identical, and half of same-sex twins are fraternal. I don't have zygosity, so I'll have to be satisfied with that. But still, the concordance is 47%. Opposite-sex twins are all fraternal, so they bear the same relationship genetically as to opposite-sex full siblings, and here is where you see the 2.6 times difference. So there's a lot of evidence for heritability in these data, but there's a lot of evidence for environmental and social processes. Okay, so how can we explain this? One idea is that actually the family resemblance or the heritability of autism arises from de novo mutations. Now, de novo mutations are sporadic mutations in germ cells that are absent in parents' genes but still contribute to heritability. So these are copy errors that will contribute to the appearance of heritability. That is, if there's a copy error, both children will have it if they both get it. And one thing we know about de novo mutations is that they're associated with rising parental age at first birth, at childbirth. So can we see evidence that de novo mutations are in some ways responsible for increased prevalence? If they were, we would expect a couple interesting things. These mutations are extremely rare events. So if we observe them and they're responsible for some component of autism, then for identical twins, because mutations are very rare, they should affect both twins simultaneously. It's a single mutation at conception will affect both twins simultaneously. On the other hand, we should observe decreased concordance for fraternal twins. The mutations are extremely rare events, so the probability of them happening twice is very small. It's likely that they could happen once, but if they happen once, they won't happen again, and so the pairs of fraternal twins will be discordant. So actually, we can test this hypothesis. I mentioned earlier, I don't know zygosity. I don't know if they're identical or fraternal, but we can proxy that with same-sex and opposite-sex twins. It's a conservative test. All of my opposite-sex twins are necessarily fraternal, so we should expect decreased concordance for them. All of my same-sex twins are not identical. Half of them are fraternal. So the pattern will be muted. Whatever's there should mute the pattern. Here are the results. It's super interesting, I think, anyway. This is concordance moving up from 0% to 60%. I'm looking at three birth cohorts. I'm looking at all the twin pairs born in 1992 to 1994. I'm comparing them to those born between 95 and 97 and 98 and 2000. So I'm looking at changes in genetics over time. And you can observe that for same-sex twins, concordance in these birth cohorts increases quite dramatically over time, even though 50% of them are fraternal. And concordance for opposite-sex twins decreases over time. At the same time, what we need is a mechanism. The mechanism is that mutations occur with rising mean parental age. And here we can observe that mean parental age is 30.6 in 1992. And up to 32 in 2000. So we have a pattern that's consistent with the hypothesis. Rising parental age at twin birth leads to de novo mutations, which express themselves as differential concordance by twin type. We can actually look at the relationship between concordance and age of parents at first birth of twins, and you can see an inflection point right here around age 35. As parents of same-sex twins turn 35, concordance shoots up as expected. And as parents of opposite-sex twins turn age 35, concordance decreases as expected. So it looks, in summary, that de novo mutations, which have been shown to play a role in a whole array of neurological disorders, especially schizophrenia, may also play a role with autism. Here we see evidence consistent with that idea. And the basic point from a sociological point of view, the part that I'm most interested in, is that a very subtle large-scale social demographic change, a very subtle two-year increase in age of parents, leads to a very subtle change in the probability of observing a mutation and consequently a proposed mechanism for the increased prevalence of autism. Now, that's this part on genetics. Now let me turn to a more general problem, which is how do we think about risk factors over time? I showed that first slide that said, here's the mess we're involved in. It's all of these single studies that say, oh, on this population, this thing is more important, this thing is more important. They're all contradictory. And one of the ideas that lies behind my thinking here is that they're contradictory because we're not really controlling for time. So here, I'll use an example for parental age, focusing on the difference between paternal age and maternal age as a risk factor for autism. But the point will be generalizable to everything that changes over time. So that is the claim. It's now believed that paternal age is thought to be a greater risk factor than maternal age. So this is the first basic science finding, is that if you look at the literature now, people believe that paternal age is more important than maternal age. But the demographic facts are the following. Paternal age and maternal age, as you saw from the previous slide, are both going up. But paternal age, especially in California, you can imagine, is increasing more rapidly and evidencing more skew relative to maternal age. So you probably don't know Strom Thurmond, but there are just more of those guys around. For the Americans in the audience, that resonates. But do you have an equivalent? No, only, this is our scene. Only in California, South Carolina, I think. So, of course, there's a biological limit to maternal age at some point, and that limit is not found for paternal age. And so if you have a demographic change, the dads are getting older and older. So here's a really interesting result from my point of view. It entertains a thought experiment. It says, let's imagine that we have a model that explains autism. It puts in all the known risk factors for autism. And let's pretend that we're back in 1993 looking at our data and running that model and estimating the impact of maternal age and paternal age on the risk of having a child with autism. And what this shows is if you look in 1993 and you look at data that arise from 1993, the risk for paternal age is lower, the odds ratio, the relative risk is 1.45 compared to 1.6 for moms. Now we exercise our thought experiment. We add 1 year of data to our observation. We now use the 1994 data, and we still see the same pattern. But now if we add in the 1995 data, looking at 3 years of observations, pooling across the epidemic over time, suddenly paternal age looks more important than maternal age, and that is consistent over time. So the researchers now who look at the data, what they're doing is they're taking long periods of time, 10, 15, 20 years, they pool all their observations together, and they analyze those data, and they get an estimate that says that paternal age is more important than maternal age. But if you do the analysis differently, if you focus on just birth cohorts, just the kids born in any given year, use the same analysis strategy, it's always the case that maternal age is a greater risk than paternal age. Every year, year after year after year. So how does this happen? Now this is an example that I hope makes some sense to you. It uses baseball, a very, very common sport. Here are two famous baseball players, Derek Jeter and David Justice, and here are their batting averages, the number of hits they get when they're at bat, over 3 years. And notice something weird. Every year, Derek Jeter has a lower batting average than David Justice every year. 250, 253, 314, 321, 291. But when you combine it all together, miraculously, David Jeter has a higher batting average. So that's known as a reversal paradox, and here's the reason it's a reversal. You see, in this year, he's only batted 48 times, so those 48 bats don't contribute much to his total average. In this year, he's batted 582 times. He's got a lower average, but it contributes a lot to his average because it's 314, whereas Mr. Justice only bats 140 times. So by direct analogy to the pattern that we saw before, every single year, moms are greater risk. Pooled observations over time makes it look like dads are greater risk. For every year, it's always the same. This is a direct analogy for autism. Both paternal age and maternal age are associated as risk factors for autism, but previous work overestimates the effect of paternal age and underestimates the effect of maternal age because of pooling of cohorts. And so the logic of this argument is that if we want to understand risk factors, if you really want to understand what puts people at risk for autism, it means you have to think about time. So what I've been able to show for paternal age here and maternal age here is true for every single risk factor that changes over time. Over time, more babies with low birth weight survive. And as a consequence, that's a more important risk factor. Over time, more premature babies survive. As a consequence, it looks like a more important risk factor if you pool your observations. And in California, more Hispanics arrive every year. And as a consequence, it looks like Hispanic is more important. So one of the lessons here is that if you don't pay attention to time, you get into this mess where every day we'll have a new finding for autism that contradicts the old, and we won't learn anything about how to give people advice. The last part of this talk focuses on, in some sense, the most important thing that we can show is that there's spatial structuring to the autism epidemic. Again, I'll mention this again, which is if you can observe spatial clustering, that is more than expected purport numbers of cases of autism within some physically defined space, it means necessarily that what causes autism is not a global treatment. It can't be vaccines unless you have a theory that vaccines interact with a local environmental characteristic, and there's no such theory around. It can't be TV if TVs are uniform, so it has to be something that's local. And if it's local, it means it's either the result of environmental toxin, social influence, or the fact that people choose neighborhoods to live in order to get services for their children. So we would say there are three causes: environmental, social influences, or neighborhood selection. And then finally, despite what you might observe, no one has ever seen spatial clustering aside from anecdotal results, like the study that came out the other day on a spatial cluster of autism among Somalis in Minneapolis. That's not real. I mean, I'm sure it's real, but there are not enough cases to know anything. So now I'm gonna go back to the very first part of the talk where I said there must be something going on between autism and autism MR, comorbidity with autism, and I'm gonna do two things. I'm gonna look at birth clusters, where people are born, and then I'm gonna look at diagnostic clusters, where they're diagnosed. And I'm going to compare birth and diagnostic clusters with two types of autism: autism, sole autism, and then autism that's comorbid with mental retardation. So that's the comparisons that I'm going to do. And I'm going to look at birth clusters versus diagnostic clusters in order to get rid of an argument that the observation of clusters arises because people move into neighborhoods. People don't move into the neighborhoods they're born into, they're born there. So I can thereby get some more leverage. These are data just for 3 years in California, looking at the birth cohorts, all children born in 1992, 1996, and 2000. These are the same. And what you can see in red are children who are diagnosed as autism comorbid with mental retardation. In blue are children diagnosed with full-spectrum autism only. And what you can observe is that, first, the spatial clustering of autism occurs mainly in Los Angeles. And secondly, if you compare over time to where children are born, you observe a really interesting thing. First, of course, you'll see that the clusters in Los Angeles are stable. Wherever children are born and have autism in 1992 is reproduced all through the period. So these are not accidental clusters. And secondly, that there's a decoupling or separation between autism and autism MR. So whatever is going on, these etiologies that are driving out of these local neighborhoods are becoming increasingly separated from each other. So that's the data. You can see there's a small autism MR cluster up here in the valley and a small autism cluster there as well. But all of the action spatially is happening in Los Angeles. If we look at diagnostic clusters, we can see a similar pattern. There's some overlap. There's about a 0.45 correlation between the space in a diagnostic area and a birth area. There's some overlap to birth. But again, we observe most of the diagnostic activity is occurring in Los Angeles County. Again, a little bit of activity up here. And secondly, a really quite striking decoupling of these two disorders, of autism and autism comorbid with mental retardation. There's a gigantic cluster of autism comorbid with mental retardation down in San Diego and spreading east out of Los Angeles over time. How do birth clusters arise? Okay, so what are the mechanisms that produce a birth cluster? Well, there are really three things that are going on. One is compositional. Parents, and the idea would be parents who are at the greatest risk of having a child with autism, that is older parents perhaps, choose to live in similar neighborhoods. That would be a compositional cause of a birth cluster. The other idea would be that certain neighborhoods contain environmental risks and affect people who live in them. That would be an environmental cause. And finally, the third cause would be that people living in areas influence each other, and that would be a social contagion or a diffusion of information. So I'm going to disentangle these three causes. But before I do, I'm going to show some evidence for what we would call compositional effects for for autism. These are Google Earth shots of autism clusters. This is a sole autism cluster. This is an autism MR cluster. This is a cluster, an area where there's low autism in California. And it doesn't, you know, a picture is sometimes worth a thousand words. It doesn't take a lot of understanding to see that these are very different communities. This is a community of persons who have swimming pools and live in big houses. This is a burned out section of Inglewood, and low autism areas look like middle class families in California. So there's a striking SES, socioeconomic status gradient, for autism in California at the middle of the epidemic. Okay, that's the other thing. The birth clusters that we identify, we control for SES, that is we control for social status and we control for age, so we know that they're not compositional, and as a consequence, it allows us to look at whether they're environmental or social. So the idea here is to say, well, what could be in these, what could be going on that would produce a cluster of persons? And we could have we could design a test that says, well, if there's an environmental toxin, and people live in a neighborhood, and the toxin causes autism, it will have equal probability of causing severe autism or mild autism. We have no theory about the way in which the environment would express itself. You might think that the environment would express itself and cause severe autism, but it's not really necessarily true. So with respect to the way in which an environment works, it could be across the spectrum. Remember that I have autism diagnoses, I have autism evaluations at the moment of entry into the system, so I know whether children are diagnosed as severe or high functioning. On the other hand, if there's a social influence process, that is, if a child is at greater risk to an autism diagnosis because another child lives in the community with autism, and the two parents perhaps are talking to each other, and one parent teaches the other or helps the other learn how to navigate the DDS system, learn how to find a physician to care for their child, we would expect that that kind of information diffusion that would be diffused from parent to parent through parks, schools, and so on, would only operate for high-functioning autism, because only those persons, in a sense, should be subject to this kind of influence. A child with severe autism would be ascertained by the ascertainment system itself. So we have a critical test. We can actually disentangle environmental risk from social influence by looking at these communities. This is another Google Earth shot of an autism cluster. The black dots are houses where persons with autism reside. They're not exactly their houses. They're dusted a little. They're moved around. But you can see that there, whatever is going on, these are evidence of quite significant microclusters. That is, whatever is happening is cases are very close to each other in space. That's the first thing. So that would point to some sort of social process. And the second thing you might notice is some really interesting phenomenon, which is that autism clusters tend to be in development areas that are under development, associated with all sorts of construction activity and building. In this particular shot, there's a factory here, what's that stuff called? A cement factory. I forgot the word cement. A cement factory. And so there's evidence of base metal release that could cause autism. So if you look at the tangible communities, you have a tension between environmental or social causes. What we do is we try to design a test. The first thing we observe is that we observe no severe clusters of autism. So every single cluster of autism that we find is high functioning, not across the board, every year, every time we find it. And so now we can ask, is there any influence of social contagion or the diffusion of information by asking if the distance to a nearest child with autism increases one's odds or one's chances of getting autism? And if the cause is social, that is, if that's an information diffusion process, if people are learning how to get resources for their children, then distance should only matter for high-functioning autism. Here are the results of that study. Remember, I know where every child in California lives. I know where every child is born. And I know where every child in California who has autism lives. So it's very simple for every child in California to calculate the distance of the person with autism nearest to them. I've eliminated people who live in the same family, so I have a distance of 1 meter to 200 meters, 200 meters to 500 meters, 500 meters to 1 kilometer, and a distance of 1 kilometer to 2 kilometers is known as the reference group. So I'm going to compare these to that distance. And what you can see is that the closer you are to a child with autism, the more likely you are to be diagnosed as high-functioning autism. Here's the odds ratio. The estimate varies from somewhere between 1, non-significant if it crosses the red line, and over 2, for someone if you live 200 to 500 meters away from a child with autism, you're about 1.5 to 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with autism than if you live a kilometer away. These are the same odds ratios for parental age over 40, okay? So this is a big effect. If you think about effect size, you want to say, well, what's the increased effect of living near someone for autism? For high-functioning autism, it's about the size of having a father and mother over 40. Now we can ask the question, does this work for severe autism? And the answer is absolutely not. There's no evidence that distance matters at all. The one line tells us that it could be either equal or above or below the expected. That's what we would expect by chance. And every observation that we can see tells us that the chances of being diagnosed with autism as a severe case are completely insensitive to distance. So there's absolutely no evidence for contagion on severity. So let me summarize then from what we can learn from space. Birth clusters are different than diagnostic clusters. People are born places that have higher risk for autism. They're not consistently compositional. So it's not the case that the clusters are the product of the choices of certain types of people to move into neighborhoods. The spatial pattern for autism and MR autism are different, which tells us that the etiologies of those disorders are different. They're caused by different things. Social influence appears to play some role in the spatial patterns we observe, specifically by helping parents find resources to help their children, only for less severe cases. And whatever the cause of spatial clustering, it can't be produced by vaccines. Let me then sum up all the things that I think we know. Some really significant proportion of the increased caseload is diagnostic, but even if it's a significant proportion, most of the increase, 75%, is not diagnostic, which means it's caused by something. What I've tried to show today is that very subtle, large-scale social changes, changes in parental age, changes in obstetric practices, changes in the survivability of low birth weight babies, and so on, contribute to the increased incidence of autism. So they're very important large-scale social changes that are playing a role. That spatial clustering tells us that something environmental or social is going on, and we ought to pay attention to it. And finally, this most obvious point of all, which is there's no single bullet explanation for understanding the increased prevalence of autism. We have to try to slowly piece together this increase from all of these causes, genetic, social, demographic, environmental, and diagnostic. And that's my talk. This is my research team on one sunny day, which I thought you would appreciate because you don't really have that many. One sunny day in New York City. So thank you very much.
Dr. Bierman will now take questions.
Is this mine or yours?
No, that's mine. That's yours.
Okay. Sir.
Could you tell us what are the diagnostic criteria for severe autism?
Excuse me. Could you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll repeat the question. The question is what are the diagnostic criteria here for the analysis of severe autism? And what we've done is we look at the diagnostic, the DDS captures communicative, social, and repetitive disorder, and then develops a scale for all of those things. There are 14 elements. So for each year, what we do is we take that distribution, capture the range of the distribution, and then partition the range that we observe into the top quartile and the bottom quartile. So the severe are those in the bottom quartile, the high functioning are those in the top quartile. And the reason we do it this way is because in California, there's no standard metric that stayed the same over time. So a couple of things are happening. The age of diagnosis is driving down from 6 to 3 over this time period. So the 3-year-old who was diagnosed in 1992 is not comparable to the 3-year-old who's diagnosed in 2000, because if you were 3 and diagnosed and captured in the birth cohort of 1992, you would be much more severe than the 3-year-old captured from the birth cohort of 2000. And over time, the severity has decreased in California. We use a scale that drives up to about 60, and it's decreased about 15%. So these are relative severities using the DDS system.
Yes.
Those are probably both true facts. The question is, the Amish community doesn't have autism, and the Amish community doesn't use vaccines. I'm not sure I can say this as clearly. I mean, I'm not sure how clearly I can say it. It's possible that vaccines cause autism. But if they do, it's necessary that the mechanism by which the vaccine operates interacts with an environmental characteristic. Okay? In the absence of that interaction, the activation of the vaccine with something very local that's environmental, vaccines cannot cause the spatial patterning of autism that we observe. It's impossible for a global treatment, something that 90% of the population gets, to express itself locally unless there's a local activator. Now, that local activator could be a toxin, it could be another, it could be something else, but it has to reside in the local community. So I think the critical thing is, I mean, I'm going to put aside the public health issues. The critical thing is a number of ways to look at it. If you want to pursue the vaccine hypothesis, you have to have a theory about local space. And then I guess I'll say, as a public health researcher, that that vaccines are very good for children. They protect children from diseases that killed hundreds of thousands of children. And that the vaccine movement, in the absence of scientific evidence, the fact that the prevalence of autism is increased, even though Tamiflu has been pulled out of vaccines, that the presence, that the absence of any correlation there would suggest this is not the place to go. And it's a mistake, I think, to look for single bullet explanations. The autism epidemic is way too complicated to look for a single thing. The longer we do that, the more we'll be in the woods. I know it's not a satisfying answer to some, but I think that's the right answer. So I'll repeat the question in this somewhat truncated way, which is, I think I'll comment on two parts of the question. There's repeated evidence that there's a relationship between the absence of vaccination and the absence of autism. And then that's one part. And then there's a second comment, which is that the argument empirically that vaccines don't seem to be associated with autism is wrong for two reasons. One, because there's a temporal relationship between vaccination and subsequent onset of autism. That was, I think, the second point. And then finally, the comment I think is worth repeating, that the argument that vaccines don't cause autism is insulting to parents. Let me address that first, because actually I have some strong feelings. I think what's insulting to parents is to imagine that there is a simple, single silver bullet out there that explains this complex disorder with all its heterogeneity. And I think we have to move forward from that. On the temporal pattern, The temporal pattern is correct. Autism appears at that age, but the fact that things appear at the same period, at the moment in time, does not mean that one causes another. For example, it's the case that the appearance of storks in Swedish towns is associated with demographic increase. That's an actually observed fact, but obviously we know that storks don't cause babies. The reason that happens is because storks roost in chimneys. The more people there are, the more chimneys there are. The more chimneys there are, the more storks there are, and the more babies there are. So we have to really carefully disentangle correlated time series, things that happen around the same time, with cause. It's possible you're right, but the evidence seems to point the other way.
Yes.
The study shows significantly less incidence of autism than has appeared in the United States. They show the question was, what's the data cross-nationally? Do other countries have the same incidence of autism as we observe in the United States, also Canada and England? And is there some relationship between the incidence of autism and investment in children? Did I summarize the question? And the evidence, I think, is that there's significant cross-national variation. One thing that varies across those countries is investment in children, as you described. So there are different social welfare systems, so you might imagine that that's related. Another thing that varies across these countries is environmental conditions. And so, again, I think this is a really complex disorder, and until we start to pick it apart a little bit, piece by piece, we're not going to figure out which piece causes different things. It is as prevalent in England as it is in the United States, and it's not as prevalent in Sweden.
Yes,
where did so is higher parental birth correlated with higher socioeconomic status?
Yeah, it is. The question is, what's the relationship between age of parents and socioeconomic status? And the answer, they're very correlated with each other. And that makes it, of course, complicated to estimate the effect of parental age. It's also true that dad's age is highly correlated with mom's age, and so it's very difficult to disentangle the contributions of each of them. The way we do this in social science and most epidemiology is you try to control for the overlap, you control for those factors in a single model, and you try to allocate some of the risk to socioeconomic status or to parental age. The thing I didn't say, which I think is probably worth noting, I just didn't feel I had time for it, is that the socioeconomic gradient for autism, which was very strong in the United States, so much more associated with upper class parents at the beginning of our observation period in 1992, is pretty much disappeared now for the birth cohort of 2000. So whatever the socioeconomic gradient was expressing, it's no longer expressing that. And I think what it was expressing was what we would call differential ascertainment. So the children of wealthy parents were more likely to come under the observation and ascertainment of public health actors and benefit from the provisions of treatment for their children. And as autism has become more widespread and understanding of autism has diffused more widely, ascertainment is no longer so unequal by social class. So I don't think social class by itself is a mechanism for anything, but it is a mechanism for the probability of finding a resource to help your child. All parents want to help their children, and so parents who have educational resources, class resources, are just more able to do that than parents who don't. So the social class gradient has disappeared. The age effect remains. I'll repeat the question. Other than age, what other physical characteristics of parents are predictive of increased risk for autism? In California, Hispanic is an increased risk of autism for autism MR. That is a comorbid diagnosis of autism and autism MR. It's hard to interpret that. I think that this is a location where you still see in the United States differential diagnosis by social class. and language acquisition, so that the Hispanic child, I think, is still at a somewhat significant disadvantage in the diagnostic machinery of the state. And so they're more likely to be diagnosed as autism MR than straight autism. And that's important because then they'll get different treatment and maybe less effective treatment for them. Whole arrays of phenomena associated with birth are positively associated with increased risk for autism. So prematurity, low birth weight, extreme low birth weight, low Apgar on birth, and so on. These are all known risk factors. So there's a class of obstetric risk factors that have remained relatively constant over time if you analyze the data the way we did by birth cohorts. No, actually, here's the temporal pattern for birth cohorts, and this is actually pretty encouraging. I mean, encouraging is a weird word, but I think what you want to be careful about when you look at clusters is you want to make sure that they're not just statistical anomalies. That is, one-shot events that produce slightly more expected cases than you would at a particular moment in time. The question is there any temporality in the clusters for autism? And I think that the answer is that there's clearly movement. There's clearly some change over time in birth cohorts. But there's basic stability in where those cohorts are located. And there's some movement, there's more movement over time in the cohorts for autism, mental retardation, comorbidity, which suggests that it's still subject to more sociological processes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Males are four times more likely than females to be diagnosed and get autism. So the question is there a difference between genders? And male is the strongest risk factor for autism, being born male. And you can actually see something interesting here. Opposite sex twins are unnecessarily one male and one female. And the ratio of autism is 4-1 for males and females. So the concordance of 18.6% given a 4-1 given a 4-1 male to female ratio when one of the pairs is necessarily female is really striking. And it's actually evidence, I think, that there's something profoundly environmental going on at the in terms of concordance for opposite sex twins. It's quite striking. So male is a big risk factor. And it hasn't changed over time. So you might have thought that proportion male would change or the risk factor associated with male would change as autism has become more prevalent. And that has been stable over time. So that's been a very important factor. I don't control questions, but we'll get to you next. Yeah. The question is asking me to speculate on what is the environment, what are likely environmental drivers. So let me preface that by this is pure speculation. Okay. So I wouldn't go very far with what I'm going to say. I think the spatial pattern tells us some things. Unless you have a theory about diet that would be distributed across these spaces, it's kind of unlikely to me. So I think it's not that I don't see it. It just seems hard to infer dietary patterns on a spatial pattern like that. It's also the case that I think that that it's unlikely that this spatial pattern arises from airborne toxins. It's not located in places where you'd expect airborne toxicity to drive outcomes in California. There's a cluster, there's a pretty stable cluster up in the hills here, Santa Monica Hills, Topanga, that's associated with a lot of fires. But, you know, again, that's ex post reasoning. So I don't think it's airborne. I think if it's anything, it's got to be very local. And that would then make me think, because, again, remember that the clusters we observe are also very local and very small. You know, they're very tightly packed. So if it's very local, it would make me think that it's something in the ground, base metal release or toxin or pesticides. But that's really, I'm not there yet. I think we had a question here, and then we have one over there, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to learn a bit more about using time and space as a tool to analyze.
Oh, thanks so much. So the question is, I'd like to learn more about using time and space to analyze these data. And I said thanks so much, because I think this is the one contribution this is our contribution. It's very important to understand that the composition of autism is changing over time. And I think one of the reasons we're in the miasma of confusion that we're in right now is that one study's from 1992, one study's from 1998, one study's from this place, and one study's from that place. And that they're all too small to give us confidence that our understanding of the mechanisms are robust across different samples and across different time periods. So building a big data set that allows us to actually look at the effect of time, which is really looking at the effect of changing composition, is really important. Time is just a way of talking about the fact that the composition of persons changes. And space, we tend to underestimate space, I think, as social scientists and also epidemiologists, even though public health arose out of the observation that diseases and disorders have a spatial foundation. So I can infer some things from space that will tell me at least that one theory is more likely than another. I can't falsify the vaccine theory by space, but I can now say that the vaccine theory needs to interact with the spatial driver. I can't falsify the theory that diet is important, but I now need to know that whatever is my mechanism for diet has to be something that's local. So space will give us insight into what's really going on. There was a wide literature that suggested that assortative mating of persons who were highly successful in the technology sector, who lacked social skills and interactive skills, and therefore were on the Asperger's quotient, were more likely to have children diagnosed with autism. This has the unfortunate name of the geek hypothesis, I think is the proper translation. And, you know, it's a reasonable idea that we know that there's assortative mating. People marry people who are similar to each other, and so you might think it was true. I think our data falsify it. There's absolutely no evidence of excess risk in Silicon Valley. That's like the big falsification. There are tiny little pockets, but it's really not there. So actually, I thought that this was a plausible genetic mechanism, and it could account for genetic expression over a short time period if there's very strong assortative mating, but it's just not true. It's at least not true in our data, and our data are California over this time period. So it was a good idea that I think is wrong. But, you know, I like the idea. We have one question. This woman up there has been very patient. No, I haven't ruled out genetics. I mean, the problem, my data structures don't have zygosity, so. And there's vast amounts of NIH money devoted to the search for genetic markers for autism. So far, genetic markers have accounted for at most 2 to 5%, which doesn't mean that molecular genetic markers won't subsequently find more. I'm a social scientist, not a geneticist. So, I mean, that's the simple reason. I don't have a better reason. I don't actually know very much about genetics. I can read it, and but the data we have are also not ideally suited. I don't have people in my data set. I have administrative records. I have every child ever born. I have every person with autism. And from that, I can see whether there's something going on with genetics. And I think the idea that de novo mutations are associated with increased risk is a very fragile and very new idea. There's one paper in Science by Zhao that has suggested it. There's some confirmatory evidence for schizophrenia. And this study actually suggests it's plausible because we have large administrative data that are consistent with that hypothesis. So the way science should operate is this paper should get read, you know, by geneticists. That's unlikely. And they should go, oh, if that's true, I should look for copy errors here. And then they should be able to find those copy errors. So if science works the way it should, this will be some contribution. That's a big if.
Where are you going to go now with the information you have?
Back to New York. No. the question is, where am I going now? I think we are a long, long way from understanding what causes autism. I think we are very close to understanding how risk factors work over time, and I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And I think where I have to go really deeply now is to really understand what is happening at the local level in these communities. I feel like I have not come close to identifying, if there's an environmental driver, I'm nowhere near identifying it, which is an answer to a question up there. I haven't linked the toxin data effectively. There's an enormous amount of very detailed detective work that I think is necessary. So that's next year.
Do you know why males are more likely than females to be autistic?
Well, autism is a connectivity disorder, and there are lots of powerful theories about maleness and connectivity disorder. Males are more likely to have ADD and ADHD. There's a lot of evidence that autism, because it's a connectivity disorder, is also a form of an attention disorder. It's not that it's ADD, but it's related to the processing of information that's fundamental to attention. There's a large body of literature associated with Sacha Baron Cohen about testosterone in the male brain. I can't comment on that literature because I don't have data that would allow me to comment on it. I think it's not a powerful theory, but it's not a theory that's been falsified.
But would it give you any clue as to what kind of an environmental factor could affect boys differently than girls?
It should. I mean, I think if there was a clue there, I would look for it. The question was, will the fact that it's male give me some clue about the environmental factors? And I just plead ignorance. I haven't gotten there yet.
We've got time for two more questions.
Well, then we have the man and the wife. Yeah, I think, and then perhaps one of these two over here. Yeah, sir. The question is, have I looked at diagnostic practice with respect to spatial distribution? There are 21 regional centers in California, and of course, one of the things we thought was that the regional centers would vary with respect to their diagnostic practices, their assessment of severity, and that there would be a correlation between the regional centers and the clusters we observe. And amazingly, there is not. There's a 4-point difference across from the top regional center to the bottom with respect to severity. There's enormous difference in prevalence, and that, of course, between Los Angeles and Alta, California, where there's almost no incidence of autism, and there's simply no institutional relationship. So it's one of these cases where you'd think there was an institutional driver, and it's not present. There's also no institutional relationship between autism clusters and the number of physicians, the number of pediatricians, the number of pediatrician psychologists, the number of autism organizations, and the autism movement itself. Whatever is there is not institutionally driven. Super interesting. Let's see, ma'am, did you have your hand up? No, you did, I'm sorry.
Okay. I just wonder if you found any connection to the fact that the educational system recognizes autism in children that are diagnosed with autism as requiring extra help in the education system, and that some parents are
The question is there any relationship between the fact that in California and also Canada, I assume, that children with autism get special treatment in schools, and that those treatments are extra resources that parents get by virtue of having their child diagnosed as autism? And I think the answer is that every parent wants to do the best for their children. Now, that's true whether you have a child with autism, whether you have a child with mental retardation, whether you have a child who has a learning disability, or whether your child is normal with respect to those disorders. So all parents, that's our job as parents, is we try to pass on our advantages to our children. So the fact that there are resources there is absolutely fantastic for parents who can then thereby deliver those resources to their children to help them get better. Treatment helps children with autism. The earlier children are diagnosed with autism, the better their prognosis up to a certain point. So the thing that I'm concerned about, the thing that one would be concerned about, is not, is treatment available? Is it equally available to all? Do all children, are they all at the same risk to getting these benefits? And I think in our data, we can say that at the beginning of the autism increase, all children were not at the same risk. Children who have advantaged parents, educationally and income-wise, had a greater chance of getting those benefits than poor kids. That's why you see a protective factor of school lunch. A child who gets free lunch, school lunch in America, is a child on Medi-Cal, is a child who's in poverty, and the free lunch seemingly protects them from autism. It's the poverty that protects them because their parents aren't able to garner those resources. So the socioeconomic difference has disappeared, and it looks like it's more equally distributed. So I think that's, for me, that's where I would answer that question. Treatment is good. And then the last thing I'll say is, like, in the United States, there's a large literature that shows that school resources make no difference to cognitive inequality. You can throw money at schools all you want, and it makes no difference to reducing the gaps between the highest achieving kids and the lowest achieving kids. But that doesn't mean that kids shouldn't have nice schools. Right? They should have nice schools because they do, you know, it's better for them. So in this sense, I think we can be agnostic as to selection. There's no evidence that parents choose neighborhoods to live in because they get benefits, because we observe birth cohorts. That's where children are born, and the children are not moving into neighborhoods where differential services are provided. I think we're done.
This lady did have a question.
Oh, where was the question? Oh, I'm sorry. I knew it was there. I'm glad you asked the question last. It's the million-dollar question. The question is, as a species, have we polluted our environment so dramatically that essentially we can't deal with what we've done? Did I summarize it accurately? Yeah. The world's a mess. I mean, I can't answer that question, but obviously, you know, this is a less healthy world than it was 50 years ago, and humans are not doing a very good job protecting the world that we can give to our children. But that's very far from anything I know about. So you've been very kind. Thank you.
I've learned a lot from Peter Behrman, not just tonight, but in the last 2 days. He's been at UBC since Thursday evening. He's been helping my graduate students in the history department. He spent a day in the sociology department yesterday. He has an incredible generosity of spirit in terms of sharing his knowledge. My only difficulty is that he's so much smarter than me that I have a hard time following him sometimes. But I think tonight's presentation was quite striking, as much for trying to help us understand the erroneous theories that have to be set aside if we're actually to go forward and make any further sense of the epidemic in autism. But he's done exactly what I, as the principal of St. John's College, hope to have my distinguished visitors do. That is I hope that they are academic leaders in their field who are able to communicate their best ideas, to share their best work with us. I think he's done that. He's also showed us that he's only 18 months into this incredible project. He's got another 3 years to go, and perhaps 3 years from now we can get him to come back and finish the story. So will you please help me thank Peter Behrman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.